Hello, I'm Eamon Ryan and you're listening to Open Field, a new podcast bringing to focus a range of issues close to my own heart. I'm speaking to a range of individuals, from environmental campaigners, scientists, technologists, right through to musicians, athletes and artists that I meet in my everyday work. It is an open field, and I would love to receive your thoughts about this podcast. You can email me at eamon.ryan@aroctus.ie and find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. Today I'm really pleased to be with the Irish composer, Karen Power, who I met about 3 or 4 years ago. We were doing some work on a climate gathering. She came and spoke at that and spoke, I suppose, about her work, her music, and about, I'd define it as maybe listening to nature and how that influenced her work. I hope that's a good summary, Karen. I found that whole talk you gave and the work you do fascinating, and I loved it. Was a very active thing for me. It was how you listen was what I found. It kind of made me rethink about how I listen. Because so it's hard to describe unless you're doing it. Or yes. if you're kind of, but and I got that sense of listening to land or listening to the world around me. And you do it. And we'll talk about how you do it in a particular way. I'm going to throw you a curveball question. First one, where's your favorite place? Where's your favorite place to be? Natural place, nature place.
Oh, good
land
God.
Place. Where do you, is there sense? Do you have a spiritual home where you go to and think, God, in this bit of countryside or on this street, I feel very connected? Is there any place like that that's special?
Well, I would say probably no, but at the same time, yes. I suppose as a type of place.
Yeah.
Then the answer's quite an obvious answer, in that it's the sea for me. But I've had experiences in places. I think the most tangible one was in a very small little church off a lake in Austria. Okay. And the church had, behind the altar, you would go down to this little crypt. And it was one of these big, famous Austrian lakes. You know, got a boat across. And there was a big church, and then there was this smaller old one. And so I went in there with the thought of recording. Because I sometimes just do that. And I walked down into the crypt. And I was alone. Sometimes in these places, when you're just there on your own without the technology, you feel like the place has more to offer than you're getting. Like there's a weight in the air, or there's a sensation that you're not quite experiencing it. So I had this feeling in there. So I put the mics out and turned the gains up, and it was, and this is a quite a long time ago, so, and I've had experiences since, but this was the first one. And it was just extraordinary. I mean, it'll sound corny, but it just, I have never, you know, some children say that they remember being in the womb. I barely remember what happened last week. I mean, I just, you know, I don't reconnect with different parts of my childhood that way. But the only way I could describe this was this cocoon.
Wow.
It was absolutely amazing, because basically the unique parameters of that space, and because it was on a lake, all of the activities around that lake were basically coming through the ground and through the stone and then up through me. And it was just, I mean, I must have sat there for 2 hours or something. It was just, I didn't want to leave. It was the safest place I had ever been.
I saw something you do when you randomly see stuff. I saw a film about George Harrison or whatever, and he was describing some ways his experience taking LSD in terms of somewhat similar to what you said in the sense that
there were no drugs
taken.
Let's just be clear.
You were straight as a die. But that sense of kind of connectivity, I guess, or whatever, or the flow of spirit matter all around you. I don't know. But it's funny. It sounded.
Yeah, no, I don't know what what it is. Also, you know, it's. But I'm quite content not to know. I mean, I don't believe that everything needs to be translatable, to be felt or experienced. And in some ways, the moment you translate it, some of it is gone because it's not of that language. And that's
it. Can I just go back to what you said there at the very start, that obviously the sea, what is it, what you feel when you're there at the sea? What is that, what's that, why is that special over, I mean, I think I'd be honest with you, like some places in West Cork, for me, just, I have a kind of, don't know what, it's romantic, I have a sense of Spain being not too far away and the warmth coming up from the south and just the Montbrich infusion and my childhood and everything. But I also love the sea. I when you say that, but what is it in the sea? Is it the size of it? Is it the life of the energy in it?
I'm not sure. Again, I just know that it is always where I'll gravitate to. I mean, I had a bizarre, maybe the only time that it was translatable was while I was in the Arctic, and there was a day there where we were traveling all day, so we were on the boat all day, which is rare. And it was a very rough time, and so they had like bungee cord. You always knew we were in trouble. They brought out the dry biscuits and the bungee cords for the tables and chairs, and everybody looked at each other and thought, oh God. We're in for it. So we were all told to just go to your bunks and, you know, there's nothing you can do. Just try not to be sick. But I had the most amazing day because it was the first day where you could kind of try to process some of the amazing things you were experiencing. So I basically lay on my bunk, took some videos from the porthole of the sea. And about halfway through the day, I had this very strange, like my bunkmate was underneath asleep and very ill. So the whole thing was kind of quiet and you know, that moment of here we were out in the middle of the high Arctic Ocean. Like the bunk areas are tiny. The entire bathroom was overflowing with water because it was just gushing from side to side. And so it's that moment of, first of all, terror of we are so insignificant. We don't belong here. We have nothing to do with this place. The sea doesn't owe us anything, doesn't need us, doesn't. And directly after that feeling of terror came complete and utter elation with the fact that we were so insignificant and that I was so insignificant and that it was just, you know, that suddenly everything became possible or it was, a really great moment. And I don't think it could have happened anywhere else except on the sea.
Maybe then go into what, just take that example, because you, as you said, you did this work in the Arctic, recording sounds, as I recall it, under the glaciers, under the ice sheet rather. Could you explain how did that come about and what did you do and what did you hear?
Sure.
That's not too big a question, but the last one.
Sure, we've got hours, right?
That's right. Put on a log in the fire. Yeah. Sit back.
Yeah, we might cue the sound person there and just make the little crinkly sounds while we talk. I suppose I've always wanted to get to a place where there was a lot of ice. From the moment I've started seriously recording sound, I've been interested in recording ice. because it's of its fragility and its vastness. And again, it's something that is so shapeable by external and internal factors. And that kind of fascinates me because of its fragility, right? So I had been to a few locations and then I thought, okay, well, if I really want to go record ice, I have to get to the Arctic. And I found a New York residency called The Farm, and they were running artistic residencies. So basically there were 27 or 28 artists on a ship.
Most of them throwing up.
Most of them throwing up. And most of them visual artists, writers, videographers. There was just one other composer and another musician. It was a very fine jazz trumpeter. And so I was there specifically to just spend dedicated time recording the ice. So above, inside and below. And that's basically what I did for 3 weeks and tried to get myself as close as I could to icebergs and all kinds of fun things like that.
What's, when you're listening to that, when you're working with it, are you listening for rhythms? Is there music in it in its own right? Or how do you use it and can then, you said ice is malleable and breakable, and do you take the sounds and then do something with it? Or is it for the quality, is it for the sound itself? Is it for the sound you're hearing itself is what the music is for you, or is it?
It's a combination of all those things. So for me, and this is something that's been gradually developing, I consider my field recording to be the first stage of composition. So rather than field recording being to just source record, I think of it as another composer might think about sitting down and beginning a score. So for me, that's the starting point. And usually when I'm listening to a space, I'm listening for all those things. I'm listening for why I'm there, what it is that's unique about that space. Like minutely, so very, very particular sounds, but also how those sounds interact, the patterns. To say rhythm wouldn't be correct, as in I wouldn't think of it that way. I think of rhythm as something that we put on patterns. So although that might come into a piece afterwards when I bring musicians into the fold, Right there and then I'm listening for the natural patterns, the natural flow of a place, the way things interact, the fact that sound bleeds. You know, there's no such thing as a beginning and an end to a sound. Yeah. It travels, it becomes morphed by something else, it becomes subsumed by something else, or it takes something else over. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also thinking about aspects of that place or that sound that I might be interested in highlighting for musical reasons. Mm. So where I hear a connection between a sound and a potential instrument, or where I hear a connection between the way a sound moves and the way a dancer might move. Mm. So it's kind of, the act becomes multiple acts. So it becomes about what you're hearing right there and now. The very fact that I'm in the space, I've already altered the space. Mm. So I have to acknowledge that. What I will choose to do with those materials. So where I call myself a composer as opposed to a field recordist is important as well, in that I'm always composing the space. Yeah. I choose why to put microphones in a particular place. I choose why to record. You know what I mean? So
I've seen those sheets you do. I saw in one piece of work you did where you mapped out or drew. It wasn't a score sheet, but it was a time sheet almost, or a kind of a place and time sheet where you write in when things happened and what the sequence is, in a sense. But does it happen naturally, or are you orchestrating it in a sense that way?
Again, that will depend on, oftentimes when I'm recording a space, I'm not necessarily thinking of a particular piece. Yeah. So then as that piece evolves, and if those are the materials that are belonging to that piece, then my composer hat comes on and I make decisions. Mm-hmm. But I suppose fundamentally, you know, it's quite simple, in that if I'm going to record a place or go to the trouble of collecting source material from a place, then in any piece that uses that source material, it must be identifiable.
Okay.
Otherwise, what's the point? Mm-hmm. Why did I travel all that way, right? So the art of composition for me is a bit like a negotiation.
Yeah.
Between what the original sound is and how much I'm wanting to tweak it to unearth a new possibility for that sound.
And when you bring the human in, and a musician and an acoustic instrument, is another one of my leaving cert honours questions. What's your favourite instrument to use?
I couldn't possibly answer that question.
Did you play yourself?
I did. I was a very bad pianist. I have tiny hands, first of all. I'm holding my hands up to Eamon right now to prove that I have tiny hands. And I also suffered from stage fright.
Did you?
Really bad. Like, when I had piano exams, I used to, the sheet music would be on the stand and I wouldn't be able to see it.
Yeah.
I'd be so terrified that it just totally blank. Mm-hmm. I used to play jazz though. I was much better at that.
Okay.
And was able to kind of, because there were other people and it was less about that kind of, you know, doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Which.
Can I go on from the Arctic, and then you got a residency, if that's the right word, or a scholarship to go to Berlin?
Well, the project was to, spend a year in Berlin. And the arching idea was to kind of look at the city from underneath. Mm. So whether that was through the river, and of course the river does divide the city and kind of, as all rivers do, branches off and covers every angle. So, but actually the first piece that I did there, let me see. So actually I finished Instruments of Ice first when I arrived over there because it was the first moment I had. One of the great things about this year was that it was just a year to compose.
Yeah, fantastic.
Without the pressures of trying to stay alive.
Yeah, pay your way.
So I took every available moment and just like wrote constantly for the year. And so the first piece actually was the one you will have just heard, which is Instruments of Ice, which is for ensemble and Arctic ice and photographs. And then the first, this was a DAD program. So the first DAD piece was actually, it was called Once Below, and it was based on recordings made from the old war bunkers, so underneath the city. And so, yeah, that was the first piece where it was about, I suppose, that sense of place. Again,
did you go into Hitler's bunker as well? Or is that
no, that's gone, that's actually. Gone. Yeah, it's gone. There's
but
nothing
the
there.
Other ones, how, if your sense in the Austrian crypt was about the lake and energy flowing in, what was your sense underground in Berlin? Sorry for the ghoulish about it. Was there a sense of that past?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Very definitely. But also I think that well, that was the second place where I had, it's funny, I've only connected the two now that we're talking. I've never actually made that connection before, but that one of the amazing things about the bunkers in Berlin is that obviously, you know, it's loaded with a history and a past, and you know, you very definitely get that sense of because it's black down there and everything, you're relying on anybody in there in a panicked situation would have been relying on their ears, and you know, that immediately heightens your sense, senses once your eyes close down, where we overly rely on them. And in there, so there's apparent silence. So I was there on a number of evenings, and one of the guides basically took me down and then would sort of disappear somewhere in the bunker and leave me there for a number of hours, or check on me every so often. And this space, so again, it's apparently completely quiet down there. And you're walking around these tunnels and these huge doors, which, you know, you just imagine like someone trying to close that door and just, you know, then everything being feeling trapped. But a lot of the sounds are hidden. They're inaudible to the human ear because they're frequencies that are quite low, and so you can't really perceive them. But you have that same sensation that there's something missing. And so at the very deepest part, I was able to put kind of quite big contact mics onto the floor. And so imagine you're standing there in the dark, and you've got headphones on, which is immediately isolating. And you're the only one that can hear this stuff. And what happened was, again, this a connection with the place, purely because the sounds and the frequencies are so low that they actually affect your body before they get to your ears. So they travel up through you. And that's very strange, and a very challenging thing to try to even represent in any way, because it's so private. And then, you know, you've committed to making a piece of art, so it suddenly becomes public.
You're in the dark in the bunker, and you've got your headphones on, listening to these sensors, which are picking up some of the very low frequency sound vibrations effectively. That would do it if you were there for 2 or 3 hours.
Yes. And then the other thing is that the wind, because of, there are grates all over the place and they're all
gusts
connected, right? So a lot of these bunkers were built around train stations. And so, like, if a train passed somewhere, then basically you get these gusts of wind traveling through the tunnels, but you had no idea where they came from.
That's fascinating.
Or where they went. So, you know, you just, again, it's that sort of, you're just a, like a bystander.
I'm going to go to one third place, and then I've got a couple of tough questions to ask you about. But just to bring it back home, and just as an example, so maybe we can listen to something that comes from the work that's coming from it. You were doing some work around pollinators and around in the Midlands and Ireland and Offaly. Yeah. Do you want to explain that to me?
Sure. So that was a really great project. It was a Creative Ireland call from Offaly County Council. So it was a partnership between Offaly Heritage and Offaly Arts. And they were looking, they've done a lot of work on pollinators and National Pollinators Plan. And I have been wanting to spend some time listening to bees for a very long time. And so I saw this call and thought, oh, okay. So I proposed to create a piece that looked at pollinators in their natural environment. So in, let's say, a natural meadow versus pollinators, manned pollinators.
Yeah.
So with people with apiaries and beehives.
Yeah.
And basically, yeah, for 6 months, I got to spend some time in some beautiful bogs in Offaly and just listen. I spent practically a night, an overnight in Burr Castle in the gardens, where I turned up at 3 a.m. to a secret gate and was allowed in and got to meet the pollinators as the sun came up. And then befriended through the Offaly Beekeeping Association, befriended a wonderful beekeeper who reared his own queens and, you know, just totally is at one with bees. And he, we worked for a bit to figure out how I could safely put microphones into the hives without interrupting anything that was happening in there. He was fabulous. So we got to sit and listen to his bees. And I did that kind of over, because obviously the life of the hive will change depending on the temperatures and depending on, you know, so whether they're warming up the beehive or they're cooling it down, and then the frequency will also change. So the pitch and obviously what's surrounding the hive. And so, I got to make four channel recordings with two of the mics inside the hives and then two just outside at the entry and exit of the hives. And then mapped spaces in the meadows. And it was such a treat.
We might listen to some of them now. I remember years ago, I was working, we had a bike shop around, and it was great. You listened to a lot of music when you were working away, or the radio or whatever. And there was a friend, a young guy was working with us, and he was also at night a DJ in techno, kind of industrial techno. But and it was fascinating because his end of the workshop, all day I'd hear, I can't even do it now. It was fairly intense. And then sometimes I think, oh, well, you know, come on, Eamon, get over it. Don't worry about it. It's kind of because it was fairly industrial. And I said, well, your back had a lot of stuff that was very kind of, or going way back, we always had music, which was, but I couldn't help thinking that that is that sort of, is there, are we seeing in our music now, or in what we hear, or even how we communicate, that some of the things you're recording, some of those subliminal beneath the surface, not that you notice, the kind of, I was wondering, is that just a throb of technology I'm listening, you know, that he's literally, where we're growing up in an environment where it isn't the gusts going through a German railway bunker, but it is the constant background of pumps and switches and zeros and ones flying everywhere and all the heating and the controlling and the switching of it. And that's kind of changing our, without us knowing it maybe. Do you have any sense of that? That the human background noise is affecting who
Listen,
we are.
We spend 90% of our time filtering out noise, whatever you call noise. We have to in order to get on with our day. I do a lot of work with very young children around listening practices. And, you know, we kind of play this game where, you know, you sort of say, okay, so you can close your eyes. And when you close your eyes, you don't see anything anymore. So they close their eyes and say, okay, now try closing your ears. And so, of course, they all put their hands up to their ears. And then I talk and I say, but you can still hear me, right? And yeah, you know, so i.e. you can't close your ears. So we have to choose to filter. So that we're not constantly bombarded. Let me give you an example. This year, I spent this summer, I spent a huge amount of money to get to a place without human interference. And I've been doing this now for, since 2012. So what's that, 6 years?
6 years.
6 years. And every year, I seem to spend more money.
It's harder.
Trying to find locations where I can record without human interference. You know, and people say, well, you just go to a field. You go out to a field and listen to the road noise. You know, I mean, it's everywhere. I'm not like, you know, I'm not being naive here. You know, this is part of who we are and what the way things are developing. But I absolutely agree with you that it is, and I don't even think it's subconscious anymore. It's changing the way we behave and the way our sense of time, our sense of urgency. I remember having a very bizarre experience in London where we go there. It's rare I'm in London for work reasons. So this wasn't work. And we were walking down to the tube and it must have been close to like quitting time at work or something like that. And like we had nowhere to go. We weren't in a hurry. And we're walking and suddenly like I find myself practically running. And it's purely because everybody else is, you know, is rushing. There's this sense of urgency and panic. And I think, you know, good or bad, that's...
Good and bad.
Yeah, absolutely.
My last question then, if people are listening, that work you do with children or education is really interesting. And as I said, I experienced it even in that Liberty Hall talk you gave, because I was educated in terms of start listening differently. Is there any tips you could give if there's a parent out there? Is there a simple ABC, 1, 2, 3, do this, or kind of easy way that they might try with their kids or themselves even for that matter? In terms of a practical trick you have, or a tool you have, or a kind of teaching thing.
Oh, God, that's really...
which they could try and do themselves, people could do themselves. What's the way to just listen? What's the simple... is there a particular place they might go to, or a particular thing they might do just to really work on their hearing, to listen in a slightly different way. Is there any?
Well, I suppose, you know, I suppose that, like, even that idea of hearing and listening, you know, they're actually kind of quite two different things, you know, like the conscious act of listening, whereas you hear things all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, well, there's probably two different things, I think, with children. Mm. I would actually argue that what's most needed there is the space. Mm. You know, I think when, and I'm talking very, very young, you know, I think we have a tendency to kind of try to fill the space with a child.
Yeah.
I have found, I've done a lot of research around, it's called listening to the room, where I've gone into creche situations or very early year situations just to sort of listen to what's going on and to see how that space is being filled. And particularly with children where there might be, they might be particularly vulnerable children for whatever reason. Mm. And I have found that the more noise that's in that space, the less likely a child is to attempt to come into the space or to fill it. So, I mean, simple things like when you ask a child a question, don't assume just because they can't talk that they're not wanting to actually respond to that or to, you know, to kind of fill that space in their own way or in their own time, because this is another thing. I mean, we manage time as adults, but that's quite a, it's a very different thing for a child and the way they think. As people, I mean, I recommend to everybody just take the time, just listen. It doesn't matter where you are. The thing is that if you start to listen to an environment and start to hear just the way things move and the way the effect that something has on you, whether it be good or bad, then I think it changes everything. Or like if you're on holidays, I mean, you know, people take pictures all the time when they're on holidays. I don't really understand why they don't necessarily listen to the place rather than taking, like, you could take an aural snapshot as well, would be my preference.
We'll conclude on that. I'd like to thank everyone who's been listening for listening. Are you listening properly? And thank Karen for coming in and answering my Leaving Cert honours questions.
Thanks, Eamon.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this edition of Open Field. Please let me know what you think by emailing me at eamon.ryan@aroctus.ie, or you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Benedict Schlepper Connolly and Anna Conlon. The theme music is by Benedict Schlepper Connolly. You can always find the latest edition of Open Field on my website, eamonryan.ie, or on all main podcasting platforms. Bye for now.